Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to welcome back the Connecticut Partnership for Long-Term Care, helping individuals weigh the options if they're considering protecting their long-term financial security by obtaining long-term care coverage through the partnership. And we'll tell you about a series of workshops coming up where you can learn more. Then we're going to head to where the Housatonic meets Long Island Sound to call on anyone with a boat or a willingness to help improve the health and appearance of this important natural resource to come out to the 30th Stratford to Shelton Housatonic River cleanup. Then we're going to close looking for other very special volunteers and supporters for this summer's Camp Kangaroo, a bereavement camp experience offered free of charge to children across Connecticut who have suffered the death of a loved one. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Hey, the largest college fair in the area is happening this Wednesday, April 4th from 4 to 8 at the Webster Bank Arena in Bridgeport. The goal of this event is to provide a community-wide opportunity for students to see and learn about colleges and the college selection process. In addition to over 200 colleges that'll be on hand, the event will also feature speakers who'll highlight some of the major considerations in the college selection process. Admission is free and the event is open to the public. For more information about the Southern Connecticut College Fair, visit ctcollegefair.com. Well, always good to catch up with an old friend, even when the friendship is older than I originally thought when I picked up the line just a few moments ago with David Gutchen, who is the director of the Connecticut Partnership for Long-Term Care. We kind of came around to realizing that while the program has been in effect since 1992, this kind of innovative, first-of-its-kind initiative here, right here in Connecticut, we've been working together promoting the information sessions for folks to learn more about long-term care going back a decade or more. So, David, it's great to talk to you again. Thanks for joining us for a few minutes.
Thanks for having me again.
So, first of all, the Connecticut Partnership for Long-Term Care is one of the many component agencies to the Office of Policy and Management here in Connecticut?
Well, we're a program within the Office of Policy and Management, which is the governor's budget and planning agency. So we oversee the partnership program for the state. We work in conjunction with our state insurance department, as well as our Department of Rehabilitation Services, which houses our 800 number.
And Connecticut was the first state in the nation and still one of just a few that have this kind of initiative, if not still the only one, right?
Well, we were the first to develop a program in 1992, but actually I'm proud to say that there are now 45 states that have partnership programs modeled after what we have in Connecticut. So The program has greatly expanded over the years. For many years, there were just actually four partnership programs, but there was some congressional action back in 2006 that allowed for the expansion of the programs. And the reality is that every state is facing the same problem that we face in Connecticut, which is an aging population and potentially more and more people needing expensive long-term care services and then ending up and relying on their state's Medicaid program. And so the partnership program is an innovative way to try and get people to plan ahead for those future long-term care needs so that, first and foremost, they don't impoverish themselves paying for the high cost of long-term care, and then they don't become reliant on our state Medicaid program, which is funded by all of us through our state and federal taxes.
Mm. Well, we hate to use the kind of the perfect storm analogy, but you did sort of describe two of the three components that come to play here. That is the increasing expense of long-term care that is going to be, systematic and either trending flat or trending upward, presumably, or maybe even spiking up higher in the coming years. But you're also having a much greater influx of participants claiming benefits as the Connecticut population ages. But at the same time, we're hearing from sources, including a number of guests who've been on the program in the recent months, about this flight of younger people who either leave Connecticut to go pursue jobs elsewhere, they leave to go to college and then stay out of the state and don't come back. And these are a unique population because if they were to be in Connecticut and be of a mind to contract some kind of coverage through the Connecticut Partnership for Long-Term Care, they would be paying relatively lower, if not the lowest rates because of their young age, but would be paying in for a long period of time, which would be the group that is sort of helping to supplement all of the benefits that are being paid out, right?
That's exactly right. So we have a dual problem with either a static or decline in population, especially amongst younger people, specifically around what you described in terms of, you know, getting younger working age folks buying long-term care insurance, not only because they may be in there for a long period of time, but also for themselves, because long-term care can really strike at any age. People can have strokes in their 40s or 50s or have early onset dementia or
accident.
Alzheimer's. So
yeah, sure.
It's always good to have the coverage. But also from a state budget standpoint, the more people that, you know, end up needing long-term care and potentially on the Medicaid program, and a smaller tax base of younger working class people, that puts a tremendous strain on everybody else. So it's not a great equation, and it's actually happening, you know, all around the country. It may be worse in Connecticut, but as the baby boomers age and less people are having children or not as many children, we're going to have fewer people supporting folks on Social Security and on Medicare and on Medicaid. So things like the partnership to try and get people to do some sort of advanced planning for this issue is very important, and specifically important in a state like Connecticut. Most people aren't aware that Connecticut's the second most expensive state to receive nursing home care at over $154,000 a year. It's over $420 a day for two people in a nursing home room. It's second only to Alaska, where the costs are just ridiculously high at $800 a day. But this whole region of the country, the Northeast, is very, very expensive. There are parts in this country that are half as expensive as it is in Connecticut. So even though Connecticut has a relatively well-off population, even though we have large pockets of poverty and some very wealthy people, if you haven't planned for the possibility of spending $150,000+ a year, no matter how well-off you are, you could find yourself impoverished rather quickly.
Yes. And in order to head that off, or to at least provide the education for people to make the decision as to whether or not it is an appropriate or logical investment for them, you not only do programs like this and send out press releases, but you also actually host free information workshops for people to come in. And three of these are coming up, one on April 24th, one on May 2nd, and one on May 15th. So just quickly review the locations of where those workshops are, and then we'll explain to folks what they're going to learn there, and more importantly, what they don't have to be worried about if they go there. And I'm talking about getting a hard sell on some sort of an insurance policy.
Right. So the first one is April 24th at the Wethersfield Community Center in Wethersfield, and then May 2nd at the New Milford Public Library in New Milford, and then May 15th at the Quinnipiac Valley Community College in Danielson. These are free sessions for the public. They run from 6 to 8. We do a presentation, and then there's plenty of time for questions and answers. And there are no sales or solicitations allowed there. So back to your point, there's no sales pressure. We don't allow insurance agents or insurance companies to be peddling their products. People come there just to learn basic objective information about the issue of long-term care, what it is, what it isn't. Very importantly, who pays or doesn't pay for long-term care, because unfortunately programs like Medicare and health insurance, which are acute medical insurance programs, don't pay for long-term care, which is personal custodial hands-on care. That's why we have the problem, and that's why Medicaid, which is health and long-term care insurance for poor people, ends up being the program that pays for most long-term care. So I think people will come out of there with a good understanding of the risks and consequences of not planning that they face when it comes to long-term care. And then we give them information about how the partnership program through the state can help them in their planning efforts, and the special long-term care insurance we've developed that not only can help cover their long-term care services, but if they outlive their insurance, will give them the ability to access our state Medicaid program without impoverishing themselves. And we go through all the details of how that works.
Very good. Folks, if you're just tuning in, David Gutchen is with us. He's the director for the Connecticut Partnership for Long-Term Care. He's been a great resource and a good friend to the award-winning For the People and all you listeners for many years here. And the reason he's back on the program is that we're getting way ahead of the next set of information sessions coming up on April 24th, May 2nd, and May 15th across the state of Connecticut, where you can go at no charge with no fear of getting pressured into or being availed to some sort of long-term care policy. But you will get all that information, unbiased information about the need for long-term care, the ways to find and purchase quality, affordable long-term care insurance, and a way to get the needed care without depleting your assets. If you'd like to learn more, you can start by going to the Connecticut Office of Policy and Management website and accessing the long-term care partnership page, ct.gov/OPM. David, is there a direct website for folks to go to as well?
Yeah, there's much easier to go to www.ctpartnership.org, and that will get you directly to the website. So it's ctpartnership, all one word, .org, and you don't have to go through the menus for the Office of Policy and Management.
Very good.
People can also access us by calling our toll-free 800 number, which is 800-547-3443, and you can register for one of these forums either through our website directly online or by calling that 800 number.
Very good. A couple of other things that are going on that we hadn't talked about before, but I see that there is a way for those who want to learn more about the Connecticut Partnership's Producer Certification Training Program. What's that about?
Well, in our regulations for the partnerships, one of our standards is that any insurance agent, we call them producers, if they want to sell Connecticut Partnership-approved policies, and these policies are sold by private insurance companies, but they are specially approved by the state of Connecticut as meeting our special standards, those insurance agents have to go through a special training that's put on by our office here at the Office of Policy and Management. And so it's designed to make sure that agents are well-educated and fully understand how long-term care and the partnership works. So they first have to take an 8-hour prerequisite online course, and then they take a 4-hour classroom course put on by myself and my colleague Aldo Pantano at OPM. Mm-hmm. And these requirements are above and beyond any other requirements for insurance agents in Connecticut.
Very good. And also, the other thing that's going on is that Connecticut has been approved as a member of the Medicaid Asset Protection Reciprocity Compact. You talked a little bit about Medicaid a few minutes ago, but what does it mean to individuals who may already be partnership policyholders that Connecticut has become a member of this Medicaid initiative?
Well, this reciprocity compact is very important because, as I mentioned, there are 45 states with partnership programs, and all the states except for the state of California is part of this reciprocity compact. And it basically means that if you buy one of these partnership policies, and one of the special features of those policies is a provision called Medicaid asset protection, which allows the policyholder to protect an amount of their personal assets equal to what the partnership policy has paid on their behalf, they can apply to another state's Medicaid program that's part of this reciprocity compact, and they will be able to get their Medicaid asset protection recognized in that other state. And it doesn't matter when you purchase the policy, so you could have purchased that policy before Connecticut became part of this reciprocity compact, and it would still be valid in these other compact states. So Connecticut basically has reciprocity currently with 43 other states for the portability of this asset protection.
Very good. And before we let you go, David, anything else going on new or on the horizon with the programs, either as a result of things going on at the federal level, at the state level, any developments that might be occurring in the near future that could either impact the scope of the program that's already being offered here in Connecticut, or perhaps enhancing either the information, the policies themselves, the benefits, the access, or the cost?
Well, one issue that could potentially change things for the better for policyholders or potential policyholders is there are several bills in front of our Connecticut General Assembly this legislative session that would create either a tax credit or tax deduction for the premiums for long-term care insurance. And this would be for policies under our partnership program as well as regular or non-partnership long-term care policies. I don't know whether those bills will actually get fully passed and signed by the governor, but they are out there and they are having public hearings and, you know, could potentially become law. And that would certainly help in the cost for long-term care insurance and provide a greater incentive for people to purchase the policies.
Well, that's great. If they're at the public hearing stages, at least they're getting a little bit closer to the center of the radar for the legislators. So if not this year, hopefully in the future. Well, we want to thank you for being on the program again, David. It was great to hear your voice and talk to you, and glad you're still in the saddle with this innovative program. Connecticut was the first in 1992, and it's now spread to 40-some-odd states across the country, most of whom, if not all, have patterned their long-term care programs on the ones started here in Connecticut. Information sessions coming up on April 24th, May 2nd, and May 15th. If you'd like to find out more about them or the partnership and what they do, David, once again, ctpartnership.org. Very good. That's where you start. All the information is there. You can register if you want to become a producer. Partnership producer, if you're an insurance agent that might be interested in partnering with the this initiative, you can find out about that on the website as well. The state of Connecticut has joined forces with private insurance companies to provide the Connecticut residents with unbiased information about the need for long-term care through the Connecticut Partnership for Long-Term Care. And David Gutchen is the program's director. We thank you again, David, for being part of the program this morning. All right. Well, we're down here on the waterline at the mouth of the Housatonic River in Long Island Sound, calling all boaters within the sound of our voice that can get up to the Housatonic River or down the Housatonic River from Derby or Shelton. It's time for the 30th Stratford to Shelton River cleanup. It's happening on April 21st. HousatonicRiverCleanup.org is their website. And I'm here with a couple of folks who've been involved with this organization and this effort for quite a long time. The director of operations for the Shelton piece of this project is Leon Sylvester. We'll talk with him in a few minutes. The chairman for the entire project for the Housatonic River cleanup is Scott Mitchell. We're here with him at his waterfront location right by the Dock Shopping Center in Stratford. So pretty exciting. 30 years on, Scott, let's talk a little bit about what you remember from before you got engaged and all the work that you've done since 5 or 6 years on.
This project is celebrating its 30th year, which is pretty impressive on its own. From what I've learned through this organization is that people have been involved from boat clubs to independent people, anyone who has a love for the water and that kind of thing. And this year it's right with Earth Day. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great year to come out and participate if you haven't in the past. It's a lot of fun. It's good natured. And you never know what you're going to find when you're out there.
That's right. I imagine once in a while somebody pulls something quite treasured out of the muck.
As they say, one man's trash is another man's treasure. And here in Stratford, we were a large glass bottle producing area back in the day. And sometimes we see some pretty neat things come out of the water.
Now, tell me a little bit of something about the location that we're at here at the mouth of the river. Is it sort of a collection point for anything that's coming down? And how does each winter's varying amount of snowfall and runoff impact the amount of stuff that builds up on the river shores and on the bottom?
It's an interesting scenario. We deal with many different things. As you say, the water line, the tide line comes up, floods your backyard, you lost a 5-gallon bucket, the kid's swimming pool. Some years it's docks, some years it's boats. It varies. A big problem that we have are the reeds that get down by some of the other organizations that float downriver and jam things up. So it can be anything. It's definitely a lot of stuff and a lot of variables.
And what is the feedback that you get from folks that are more drilled into the environmental side of things, the necessity for this and the good that it does, not only for the morale of the people that are making things a little bit cleaner, but for the health of both the rivers and the communities that border it?
Well, I think I'm going to let Leon answer that because he has a little more of the true environmental background than I do.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah. Well, it's just a great way for anyone that is interested in either an aspect of the environmental side, or in my case, I'm an angler, so we get a lot of participation from the fishing community. But it just gives us an opportunity to really see what type of things, you know, Scott mentioned a lot of the different things that come down the river. Something to consider is a lot of times we have strong storms in the spring and this time of year that wash everything, basically, like Scott said, from backyards into the river. So we see everything from toys. And it's not only the lower tidal river that we clean, but also upriver from here. You know, everything kind of washes downriver into the Sound. So what we try to do is, as much as we can prevent while cleaning our river, but we're preventing that from getting into Long Island Sound as well. So, and that's important because our river is really a really important tidal estuary for the breeding of so many different fish species, bird species. This time of year, we have the endangered blueback and alewife herring populations returning to the river to spawn, and they're trying to get into the small creeks off the main river. We have osprey returning from South America that are here to feed on those birds. We have all the different wildlife that kind of uses the river for subsistence. So it's important to get things like plastics and styrofoam and like Scott said, I mean, you never know what you're going to find. Glass. Those are the consistent things that we find. Then there's all the variables that come, and just unfortunately people feel that out of sight, out of mind is a better way to do it, and water gives them an opportunity to do that. So, you know, anything we can find, we try to get out, and year after year, it's always there, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was going to mention that because it seems like over the past 20 years, maybe more concentrated over the past 10, there's been a real effort to try to create spaces along the Housatonic so that people could, especially even, or I should say, even individuals that might be wheelchair bound or disabled. There's a lot of locations where people could just essentially park their car and walk down to the river. And then there's vast open stretches, whether it's like kind of naturally formed beach areas or waterside areas, or areas that are specifically created by municipalities or the state for individuals to come down, boat launches and such. While these are great opportunities for people to be able to access the river for fishing, recreation, swimming, what have you, it also provides a lot of little areas where people can either leave the stuff they brought instead of taking it back with them, or even the unscrupulous folks that go to those areas to dump stuff.
Sure. Yeah, that's a problem. You know, a good thing we have is there is a lot of access points to the tidal Housatonic here, and that brings this time of year, we have anglers showing up here from not only our local anglers, but you'll find people from New York, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, New Hampshire that come all the way down here to fish for stripers this time of year. So those people, and of course with the use of the internet now, gives them easy access to find these access points. People come that don't really have an invested interest in this being their backyard. And again, you know, unfortunately, some people feel that just it's other person's responsibility to pick up their trash when they leave, and all that eventually ends up in the river. Because we are a tidal river, the tide comes in and out. So if you leave it on the beach, it ends up in the water, and then it gets washed down river to different places down here that we have to clean. We have a lot of marsh islands within the tidal area that catch all this stuff. So I tell people all the time, they're like, well, you know, the river doesn't look that dirty. I drove down. You can literally take a 10 by 10 square, and if you were willing to pick littles, you know, small pieces, yeah, an inch or smaller, yeah, things, you could spend a whole day picking that out of not going any deeper than 6 inches of dirt. It's just amazing how much builds up and breaks up over the years and kind of becomes part of the environment. And then, you know, I'm not a scientist, but eventually the fish eat it because they think it's food, and then eventually it's passed on to, you know, human consumption. So it's a big, you know, it's a big responsibility. We do what we can, but we need more people, more boats, more sponsors to make it better. I mean, that's really what we would do.
Well, you also make a really important point, Leon, that folks can either access these cleanup points by walking to them from the shore, but there's also a massive need for anybody with a boat that can carry both the pilot of the boat and one or more others to places, I would imagine, that are many more places that aren't directly or easily accessible from the shore, right?
That is correct. There are thousands of points that you can pick along this river that have high grass, low grass, muddy shores, sandy shores that you can't really get to by walking or any other way by boat. So if you can bring your boat and your family and your friends and grab a few trash bags and help us out, we would greatly appreciate it, and so would the environment.
And literally anybody that has a boat, no matter where they are, if they can access the mouth of the Housatonic River, even folks that are friends are listening out on Long Island, they can make a day out of it and come over. And I understand there's also some opportunities because there's a lot of school districts and other entities that require service hours. And this is a good way to eat up a lot of that time for these young people that have these mandated kind of school-based programs, right?
Yeah. Two things. Back to the boat point real quick. Yeah. Anybody that's willing to bring a boat or a crew, I think it's important. We don't require that you stay for the full 6 hours of the event. We just ask you come check in at one of our points at Bird's Eye Boat Ramp in Stratford or Sunnyside Boat Ramp in Shelton. Sign in. We give you a t-shirt. We'll give you all the supplies you need. You can go for a run, a jog, take a bag and just pick up garbage along the riverbank, or you can jump on your boat with your friends, or you can help us run crews of people at different points. Come over, we'll find you a dock somewhere. You know, we'll take care of all that, depending on where you want to work on the river. As far as the children go, unfortunately, we can't have, you know, young children unsupervised, but if groups of Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, things like that want to get together with their scout masters, we can facilitate that. High school children in our area need community service hours to move up per grade, and we are enabled to sign off on those hours for those schools. So we can provide up to 6 hours if they're there for the entire event. If they only come for three, if they only need an hour, whatever they need to do, they can come to one of our locations. We could sign off on their community service form, and they can get the hours while doing the cleanup.
You can think of a lot of things to do that are not a lot of fun, but this really sounds like it's a good time. Scott Mitchell, you've been involved now for 5 or 6 years and have known about this effort for many more. Tell me about the spirit of the volunteers, and because it really it sounds like an awesome time.
It is an awesome time. How often do you get it to go outside and have some fun and be with people and be quote unquote even a little competitive on who's getting what and how much we're doing, and see different things? You're seeing anything from the oystermen on the river that are helping us out to professional clammers that are coming in and helping us out with things. So there's a learning process there, or a little education. The town of Stratford provides the public works department to scoop up some of this big stuff. Sometimes you're seeing 60-foot trees come in. Sometimes you're bailing big pieces of foam. And I think everybody has fun, and everybody gets to see just something a little different. And like you said, it's not a ton of work, but you're doing something, you're making the world a better place, quote unquote, mm-hmm. and you're hanging out with your friends, and you know, you might go for a ride up and down the river too, and end up in an
island, some fresh air,
and end up on an island or something. I mean, how many people get to do that on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon?
That's a great point. Everybody that's interested, you know, it is an opportunity for kids or grown-ups to get on a boat, take a ride, go to a, you know, a spot on the river you would never get to on your own unless you own a boat. And we're willing to go out there, and we give you that opportunity. And we also have firefighters, police, you know, first responders. Hopefully this year, I believe U.S. Fish and Wildlife is going to help us out a little bit. But we get professionals out there to make sure it's safe and no one gets hurt.
Excellent. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more with Scott Mitchell, who is the chairman of the Housatonic River Cleanup here in 2018. It's coming up on April 21st. Leon Sylvester is also here with us. He's the director of operations for the Shelton part of this effort. It's all happening here. It's the 30th Stratford to Shelton River Cleanup, April 21st. We'll tell you more about how to get involved with that and talk a little bit more about getting the help that they need to make it successful. We'll be right back.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. Love CT also has funds to donate to a local charity. If you're part of or know of an organization in Connecticut and would like to be a beneficiary of the Love CT grant fund, submit your request at LoveCT.org. Look for Love CT all over Connecticut and get involved. Love CT is powered by Allied Building Products, Planet Fitness, and Chip's Family Restaurant. Learn more or apply for the grant at LoveCT.org. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People this Easter morning right after this news. Working smoke alarms in a home cut the risk of death by half, and the American Red Cross is seeking people to volunteer their time and help save lives at the Sound the Alarm Home Fire Safety and Smoke Alarm Installation event coming up April 28th in New Haven from 8 to 2. Sound the alarm in New Haven and be part of the nationwide Red Cross effort to help reduce the number of deaths and injuries from home fires. Volunteer signups are available for both individuals and teams, so grab your friends and family and help make a difference together. All you need to do is go to soundthealarm.org/Connecticut.
All right, we're back here on the mouth of the Housatonic River with Scott Mitchell, chairman of the 30th Stratford to Shelton River Cleanup. It's coming up April 21st. Leon Sylvester is here with us representing Shelton. He's director of operations for the Shelton wing of this effort. HousatonicRiverCleanup.org is the website to go to learn more. If you've missed any part of the broadcast, you can get caught up on all of the details that you need. So let's talk about anybody who's concerned because they hear the program. Sounds like a great idea, but they've got this brand new or very, very expensive watercraft, and they're worried about having people, volunteers, coming onto their boat. They're worried about maybe the boat getting damaged. Talk a little bit about how you keep everybody safe and getting along and deal with the liability issues.
Well, the first thing is, if they're bringing their boat, we're very excited. And it's their boat, so they can kind of control where they're going or where they're not going. Mm-hmm. They can put themselves on a nice sandy beach. They can pull themselves up into a little bit of water. People are in their boots. They can get in. They can get out. They can gather up things, and we can send one of the Oyster Scows up to pick things up. So I don't think safety in that regard or damaging a boat is too much of a concern. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the captain's responsible for his own ship. Isn't that what they say?
Yes. And how about supplies or materials? What do people need to come with versus stuff that you'll supply them to get the job done?
I think they need to come with a great attitude and be ready to have some fun. Other than that, we have gloves, we have trash bags, we have water, we have all the essentials that they need, and they even get a t-shirt for their help with this. So it's really just bring some friends, come on down and have some fun. And that's what it's all about. Put the video games down. Let's go.
Dress weather appropriate.
Yeah, well, Leon, I was going to say, Leon mentioned a lot of fishermen have a vested interest in keeping these water sites clear. They go down to these water sites. They don't want to be sidestepping through garbage and maybe some dangerous waste on the side of the river. Should folks who have them come with like hip boots or waders or things like that?
Absolutely.
I mean, how do you sort of match the outfitting to where they do the cleanup?
That kind of answers its own question. Okay. We fit where they're going to be cleaning based on what they're wearing. I mean, if you want to be adventurous, you got a pair of hip boots. We will put you in a spot to help us, you know, that. And those are the spots that we want the most. So if you do have hip boots, waders, and willing to get a little dirty that day, we'll find a spot for you, and, you know, it'll be greatly appreciated. That's kind of what I wear that day. I mean, I'm getting dirty. We have guys that will jump out of the boats, grab the boats, bring them closer to shore, so people that aren't wearing the greatest of, you know, footwear can get safely to dry land, and they can clean beaches or drier spots, parks, things like that. But it really all depends on what you're willing to do and how involved you want to get. But we have, fortunately and unfortunately, we have enough places to clean regardless of what you're wearing. You're able to find somewhere that you can do it that make a difference. So,
you know. And in the 6 hours or so that this is getting done, do you have the potential to actually scrub a good portion of the Shelton to Stratford waterfront?
To give you an idea, not only do we have dumpsters along the river, like the marina that we're at now has a 40-yard dumpster that hangs above the water so boats can pull up and throw things right into. Okay. We have large commercial vessels that come up and grab bigger things. I don't know the exact totals, but they do keep a chart of how many pounds of material we've collected.
Between the two locations, it's been, believe it or not, between 30 and 50 tons every year is taken out of the river. And it doesn't change. You would think it gets less and less, but unfortunately it just changes the material or the size of the items. But that's about what we pull out between the two locations. Obviously, more volunteers, the more we can do, but that's on average what we've been doing.
And this is all donation-driven?
All donation-driven. And it's everybody, from an individual who lives along the river, who can't get out there and clean up it themselves, it feels bad, to Home Depot, to the town of Stratford, to the donut places, to pizza place. It's everybody. So we appreciate all that, and we can use as much as you can give us.
How about in terms of supplies or like, should people be bringing like rakes or if somebody has an ability to donate tools or equipment? Are there anything you all need?
Really, it's just, like I said, dress appropriately for the day. In specific locations, if you have a pickup truck, we could potentially use that. But really, other than that, we provide everything you really need to pick up what to bag it, things like that, and dispose of it. I mean, we'll give you that when you sign in. We don't expect people to bring their own equipment for that. If you have something, you know, we're always open to ideas. So, I mean, if someone thinks of something or has an area in mind they live near or they drive by or they run by and it, you know, bothers them that it's a mess and it needs some kind of equipment, contact us and maybe we can help put you in touch with other people that, you know, facilitate it to make it work. And you can, so we're by no means we run it, but we're always looking for ideas. And if people are interested in participating or being involved in it, come talk to us or just contact us.
Yeah, and if people like the idea, but they can't be here that day, they could get a gift card to give to you guys that you could use for like sandwiches at a grocery store or bring you some heavy duty bags or stuff like that.
Any of that stuff. Gloves are a big commodity for us. The pickers that you get to grab things off the ground, those are another thing that we use a lot of. Cases of water to keep people in good spirits as the day goes on. You know, and it's interesting because we were talking about specialty tools and how we do things. A few years back, we went in with some ATVs and cleaned up an area behind Ashcroft. And, you know, so that was unique. People got to go in there and do that and ride on a trailer and load things up. So we're always open for whatever it takes to get something done. And we also do, part of this is Green Sweep, which is the public parks in the town of Stratford. So if you're not a comfortable water person, this, that, or the other, you got your favorite park where you walk your dog or whatever you see, we can get you dispatched over there with the materials you need as well on that day.
And they can all get that information through HoosatonicRiverCleanup.org.
Yeah, and also on the Facebook, it's the Housatonic River Cleanup LLC.
Good. Okay. Super. Well, we'll have folks be in touch with you either through the Facebook site or the website. We want to thank you for having us down here today and giving us a heads up. We hope folks that are listening way down in Stamford and Greenwich or perhaps way up in the Guilford or Old Saybrook areas want to come down the coast with their boat and make a day of it over from Long Island or certainly anywhere between the mouth of the Housatonic here in Stratford all the way up to Shelton and Derby. HousatonicRiverCleanup.org is the website or check them out on Facebook. We want to thank the chairperson of this year's event, the 30th Stratford to Shelton River Cleanup on April 21st, Scott Mitchell, here at Boardwalk Marina, as well as Leon Sylvester, who's director of operations and an employee up in the town, the city of Shelton. Thank you guys for having us, and good luck with the event.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are out here in Middlebury, Connecticut, on the road this morning talking with some great folks from Seasons Hospice and Palliative Care of Connecticut, and we're going to be talking about a very positive experience for young people who may have been through a really terrible experience. If you know somebody who's aged 5 to 17 who has been through or suffered the death of a loved one, then we're interested in having them spend a couple of days at Camp Kangaroo. It's a bereavement camp experience offered free of charge to children in the community who have suffered a loss, and participants receive grief education and emotional support combined with a fun camp experience. We're pleased here to be here today with Michael Bonanno. He's director of Hospice Care Consultants, and I understand you're heading off to a big national job. So congratulations, my
Thank
friend.
You very much.
Darlene shares all. Darlene Miakos is here. She's the camp co-director and volunteer director. And I'm also pleased to have a very special guest, hospice RN and educator Roberta Gould, who is going to talk a little bit about having some colleagues join her for the first time working at the camp this coming June 22nd through 24th. May 25th is the deadline to register, and we're going to tell you now and a few times through the broadcast that you can go to seasonsfoundation.org and follow the prompts to get information and register for the camp. So let's start with you, Michael. Tell us a little bit about what you know. I imagine you've been to the camp or know a lot about it. What are some of the things that have really struck you in terms of its success and its ability to help some of these kids transition with an experience that they really probably shouldn't have ever been facing at that age?
Really, Camp Kangaroo is an amazing experience. It's a bereavement camp, as you mentioned. It's for kids ages 5 to 17. And it's really the only camp of its kind nationwide to focus on the kids. When there's a death of a loved one, the adults and parents are really dealing with their own grief and really struggling with themselves. And really, this camp helps allow those kids to have fun activities as well as understand how to deal with the emotional support. I recently lost my mother in June. I have 4 children, and I just understand that I'm struggling with the pieces that I'm dealing with. And sometimes we neglect what they need. And it's not intentional. It's just the way it is. And this camp allows kids to understand that and to really get their arms around grief and to know there's other people like them. There's other kids that are dealing with similar things. And this allows them to have the support that they need.
You make a really important point, Michael, because when young people face the death of a loved one, whether it's a sibling, a parent, a grandparent, somebody who's very close to them, a close friend perhaps even, the parents or the caregivers are going through their own world of grief in their own way. And I guess a lot of times, they're not professionally trained like individuals at the camp. And this is not only a good thing for the kids to be able to be kind of immersed with peers who have shared the experience, but also to give the parents a break for a couple of days so that they can kind of be in their own world. And maybe by the child being away and getting support, it's helping the other adult loved ones too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really part of the idea is just how can we support the community differently? And that's why we started this camp in 2012 in our home state of Illinois, where our home office is. They've been doing the camp there for over 5 years. And now we were at the time that we wanted to participate in it. So we created this camp June 22nd to June 24th, again, ages 5 to 17. For any child that has had any kind of loss, they do not have to have been on Seasons Hospice. We're looking for any kid that has any loss that is really struggling with it. And we will do an assessment on that child, the social work team, to make sure that they're eligible for us. And it'll be an overnight camp, again, from June 22nd to June 24th, and again, to give them the tools and resources they need to function and to be able to carry on.
Great. Well, part of what a lot of people may not understand is if they engage hospice long enough in a situation, they'll benefit from people like Roberta Gould here, who does education with the families. When there's a prolonged period between when hospice encounters the patient and the patient passes, there's a really holistic kind of wrapping experience where even the children, fairly young, are brought in and educated, and they come along. But I understand Camp Kangaroo is most particularly beneficial when young people experience a more immediate or sudden death of someone who they love.
Yeah, I think ultimately any child can benefit from it, but when it is sudden, and a lot of times the children are on the outside of the disease, if the parent has cancer, sometimes we've seen the family doesn't want to give that information to the child, so they find out towards the end of that patient's journey, and it can be sudden to the children, and that's when it's most difficult and where the camp has a great benefit. But again, any child that's had any loss is where the benefit is.
Yeah. I did want to take a quick opportunity to talk about hospice, because it's something that I've been advocating for on this program on the award-winning For the People for almost 30 years. For folks who are facing the death of a loved one, I guess a lot of people somehow still have the impression that hospice is sort of for the final 24, 48, 72 hours. But the two things that I keep trying to drive home and use and take advantage of meeting with folks like you to do is to remind people that folks can go on hospice 6 months, a year, or more ahead of time, and once in a while, somebody leaves hospice, sure, and they survive.
Yep. Nationally, 7% of patients graduate from hospice care. Ultimately, everybody knows someone that's been on hospice for 24 hours, so everyone remembers that experience. But we, our average patient is on service for over 3 months, and we have plenty of patients that are 6 months, 8 months, 12 months. We have some patients that are over 2 years, where they keep there's a qualification process, and they keep qualifying, but they've been on service for that long. And I think that's where you get the benefit of hospice. When our team gets to meet the family, they get connected to the social workers and the rest of the nursing team and all the clinical people that we have, that's when hospice really has its benefit. And we really provide that support and extra care that families and patients need. The other thing that we do is we give 13 months of bereavement after the patient passes. That's something that some families don't think they need, but a lot of families do need, and we help support that. We have a great team of social workers, chaplains, music therapists, our nurses, of course. Everyone on the Seasons team is amazing and really wants to give that extra to those families and patients.
Excellent. Folks, if you're hearing something you're interested in, or you think you have a young person age 5 to 17 who might benefit from attending Camp Kangaroo, which is just up in Plymouth off between Torrington and Bristol, very easy to get to. It is an overnight experience from June 22nd through 24th. You just need to go to seasons.foundation.org and follow the prompts for Camp Kangaroo to get things started as far as getting people to the camp. Darlene, talk about the recruiting process and what people need to expect when they pull up that application and a few of the things that they're going to have to do to be able to introduce and perhaps qualify the young person in their lives for Camp Kangaroo.
Well, when they go online, they fill out the application for their child, and the process is our social workers then go out and do the assessment. Outside of that, I'm also the camp co-director, which one of my responsibilities is for recruitment of volunteers that would like to spend the weekend with us, whether it's overnight as a Roo Buddy, which they sleep in the cabins with the children and other professionals from our team, or they come for a few hours a day throughout the weekend. We're looking for art therapists. We're looking for music therapists. The same process, you would go on Seasons, our website, and there's a link to apply for volunteering. There's the camp with the children. There's so many different things that we do with them throughout the day. You know, we go ahead and we do pull the Band-Aid off the wound through intense counseling with educated personnel. And then when they come out of their counseling sessions, the volunteers and other team members are there to help do other activities, therapeutic art projects. Of course, there's a lake. We're going to have different things like that. So we do need, you know, people from the community to volunteer their time, which is going to be an amazing experience. I had the privilege of attending one of our Camp Kangaroos, and everyone had their hands on, and every person played a very important role of helping these children through the bereavement process.
So Roberta Gould is a hospice RN and educator. She's one of the people that Michael and I were talking about a little bit earlier, who, if given the opportunity, can spend a lot of time with families who are going through the process of saying farewell to someone that they love, whether in an institutional setting or in their home. And Roberta, I understand you actually ran into somebody or had somebody that you interacted with a few months ago who you immediately thought, wow, this could be a good candidate for Camp Kangaroo.
Absolutely. So in the process of putting this Camp Kangaroo together, it was not in my forefront of my mind, but I had ran into an old friend who had lost his own son. And as he was talking to me, I felt like it was therapy for him to talk about it. So I asked the questions little at a time until he felt comfortable talking to me. And then after a while, I went back to him and I said, you know, we're putting on this great camp for these children, but I think your grieving process may help. It may help you to be with the children who are grieving other people. So that is something that was being pursued by Darlene. We've touched on a few things so far. We've talked about educating families. We've talked about some of the patients and families only having a few short days with hospice or length of time over a year. Sometimes we are taught, as a nurse, I am educating these families, these patients, but the children often don't get the education because the adults are the needy ones. So now these children who have experienced loss, they don't know what to do with their grief because they're not always involved in that counseling. And I'm speaking about hospice patients, but grief can extend to anyone. There are so many overdoses in the community right now with young children dying. They have siblings. These children don't know what to do because their parents are grieving. This camp is so fantastic, and I would reach out to any of my colleagues, nurses, medical staff. This is something we can have such a great impact on these young children who don't know how to express their grief because they're no one's teaching them because the families are having their own grief sessions. So sometimes it's overlooked. And, you know, a child may experience loss today but not act out for 5 years. Mm. And then all of a sudden you have this child who's acting out, and it's maybe because nobody really touched on the fact that they lost a very dear friend or a loved one. You know, this is a great opportunity to reach in and reach these children when it counts the most before they become adults.
And doctors, nurses, and medical professionals who may be really good candidates to be considered for the camp, they don't have to be hospice specialists to be able to provide a great support system for these few days.
No, and they don't. You know, I'm reaching out to the medical profession, but we can have just someone who is so passionate about children, they don't have to have medical experience to come and offer support to these children.
If you're out there and you're a parent or caregiver of a young person, then we would also like you to be part of it. College students, of course, are always welcome. There's a place for virtually everybody at Camp Kangaroo, as long as you care about the mission of making sure that the young people attending are assisted and supported through the tragedy that they faced, whether rather immediately or, as you heard from Roberta, years ago. May 25th is the deadline for folks who want to register to get their kids in fundraising. Oh, let's talk about that real quick.
You can also visit the same website to donate $5, $10, $25, corporate sponsors, $1,500, and your logo goes on the back of our t-shirts, and you are also invited on our closing ceremony on Sunday. You can also sponsor a child for $300. You can call our office at 203-490-1000 if you have any questions on the fundraising, or you can visit the website.
Excellent. I want to thank our guests this morning, RN Roberta Gould, a hospice nurse and educator, Darlene Miyakos, who's a camp co-director and the director of volunteers here at Seasons, as well as Michael Bonanno, director of hospice care consultants. We are here at Seasons Hospice and Palliative Care of Connecticut in Middlebury, and we hope you'll get involved with Camp Kangaroo, whether you have a young person in your life who may benefit from it or maybe you'll benefit from it, too. Once again, seasonsfoundation.org is where it all starts. Thanks, folks, for having us.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.